Okay, so let's begin with this reflection and just really from the outset to say this is not a guided meditation. So if you find that sitting with your eyes closed induces a state slightly soporific, it is better to open them. Okay? So when I started to reflect on this theme or this question of embodiment, my first step was to go to the dictionary, see what the dictionary said. And it was actually quite illuminating. As the dictionary defines embodiment as the visible or tangible expression of a quality. The visible or tangible expression of a quality. So clearly when we speak about embodiment, we're not speaking about good ideas. We're not speaking about good intentions alone. We are speaking about that which is tangible and that which is visible. So my understanding as I've gone into this reflection is to really have a sense that embodiment really lies at the heart of the Buddha's teaching. And as such, it really is a question that concerns it all. Because it is an investigation that speaks to the question of our aspirations and longings as human beings. It speaks to the kind of relationships that we form with ourselves, with others. And I think in its deepest sense, embodiment is a synonym for nibbana, or liberation. So I see these different dimensions of embodiment. One is that this is certainly a path. Embodiment is a cultivation, it's an investigation of the entirety of our lives. I see it as a virtue, because embodiment is a commitment to that which is ennobling, that which is ethical, that which brings dignity. And I see it as a fruition. You know, if we think about the Buddha, or we think about the nature of an awakened mind, we would anticipate there to be the visible or tangible expression of that awakening. So as a path, let's look at this. First of all, to recognize that we are always embodying something in our life, aren't we? In our thoughts, our words, our acts, there are visible and tangible expressions of where our minds and hearts are dwelling in that moment. And everyone that we encounter in our lives is equally embodying something in their acts, thoughts, and words in ways that affect us, just as we affect the world around us with whatever it is we are embodying. Now, mostly, my sense is that the people that we admire most in our lives are our inspirations, the people we have esteem for. These are mostly the people who have the capacity to affect change in our world and affect change in themselves, and who embody their most deepest, their deepest commitments and values. You know, think of the ways that we're inspired by, you know, mandala, by Aung San Suu Kyi, by the Dalai Lama, not because they have a lot of good ideas, but because of what they actually embody in kindness, in courage, in compassion, in perseverance and fearlessness. And we admire the congruence between the values that they teach and how they live and how they actually not only articulate those values but live in the light of those values. We would be extremely surprised to suddenly read the Dalai Lama saying, you know, this has all been the wrong direction and we should all arm ourselves. You know, we would have been extremely surprised if Mother Teresa had ever said, you know, this has been a waste of time, we just leave babies on the streets to die. This is not what we anticipate or respect. Now we see the ways that we are so personally, deeply affected by those we encounter in our lives who embody rage, or who embody greed, or self-absorption. And we feel and absorb the impact of those words and acts and the kind of footprint that is left on the world and the kind of footprint that is left on our own hearts. And we are aware, perhaps sometimes less aware, of how the kind of footprint that we leave on the hearts of others and the life around us. I think for any of us who actually have an aspiration to be wakeful in our lives, who have an aspiration for sincerity and what is sometimes labeled as authenticity, the question of embodiment truly matters. And we see there are two dimensions to an embodied life. One is certainly the contemplative dimension, where we learn, we truly learn how to listen closely to our own hearts, to our own minds, and learn the lessons that our life continues to deliver to us. I'm always, you know, sometimes a little startled by how complex we make the pursuit of understanding. You know, in my experience, we just need to close our eyes and we learn everything we need to know about greed, hatred, and delusion. It's not like we need to go somewhere else. Just close your eyes and listen, and we'll figure out everything we need to learn. And the truth is, doesn't our life just keep delivering us those lessons about what suffering is and what causes suffering? You know, it takes, you know, only a little mindfulness, I think, a little wakefulness to see the ongoing lessons that our life is bringing to us about what causes distress, what causes alienation, what causes disconnection. We don't have to read 100 books. We just need to read the story of our own mind. We need, and I'm not saying that the reading is irrelevant or useless, it's often very helpful because it's a reminder. But the lessons are learned through reading the story of our own minds, our own patterning, our own reactions, and our own life. We learn the lessons from our lives, don't we, about the impact of kindness, the impact of compassion, awareness, integrity, not only upon our own consciousness, but upon the lives of others. You know, the Buddha once described one of his definitions of nibbana, or liberation, was to live without residues. To live without residues. And when we think about what that means for us, I mean, if there is sufficient sensitivity and mindfulness there, we quickly tune in to the residues of ill will, or of blame, or of greed, or of speaking or acting in ways that are really not aligned with what we value. Don't we just hear the residues in those echoing voices that says, you know, I really wish I hadn't said that. Or I really wish I'd made a different choice. Or I really wish I'd acted differently. This is what embodiment is really asking us to examine. What is a life without residues, without those echoing imprints? We certainly learn, listening inwardly, about the impact of fear and beliefs in insufficiency and greed upon our own life and the lives of others. Now, these lessons, I think, you know, and I think sometimes, you know, forgive me if the first part of today is kind of more about the bad news or what we interpret as being bad news. I think it's because we interpret this as being bad news that we actually find it difficult to learn the lessons. And this is what I referred to earlier. Our willingness to bear some discomfort in order to learn, and our willingness to bear some discomfort in order to find the way to the end of discomfort. Because we actually don't want to listen to the echoes or the residues, you know, we strategize all our ways to get away from it, you know, and then actually we don't learn. We don't learn. And I think it takes a lot of courage to actually relinquish our strategies of disconnection. But this is also what embodiment is about, is not to live a disconnected or dissociated life, simply because the journey to that life asks us to investigate and to look at the suffering and distress and the causes in our own life. So the first part, of this journey towards embodiment is this aspect of listening inwardly, the willingness and the courage to listen to the life of our own minds and hearts and to begin to learn those lessons. And this is a significant piece of the Buddha's teaching, isn't it? Learn to be still. Learn to listen. Learn to investigate. In that stillness, in that aloneness. But the second dimension of the path, and I often feel this is a dimension that is kind of somehow underestimated. So much of the Buddha's teaching is actually concerned with what we do. It's actually concerned with what we do, with how we live, with how we speak, with how we engage with the world, and how what moves us to do what we do. Now, this is dimension, I think, of the path. It's really concerned with how we live the life we have. How we live that life with those that we love and care for, how we live that life with those we fear and struggle with, and how we live that life with the countless beings that we really do not know. And it's recognizing that in every moment of our lives, whether we are silent, whether we are speaking, whether we are acting, whether we are still, every one of us is always practicing something. We are always practicing something. Consciously or unconsciously. And this dimension of the path that's concerned with what we practice, what we embody, is concerned with congruence rather than with dissonance. It's concerned with exemplifying rather than fragmenting the way that we live our lives in the light of our deepest aspirations and values or in contradiction to them. It's a dimension of the path that's actually speaking about if we value generosity, if we value ethics, if we value honesty, how do we exemplify these? We know the value of kindness and compassion and empathy, and how are they manifested in our thoughts, words, and acts. We know the ways in which a life of self-absorption, grasping, and obsession truly only causes struggle. Do we live in accordance with that understanding, with a commitment to unbinding? Now, I think one of the kind of assumptions that's made in Dhamma practice is that these dimensions of the path are somehow hierarchical. You know, that first we're going to do all this inner work seriously and conscientiously. You know, we're going to develop stillness, we're going to cultivate kindness, we're going to cultivate compassion. And then when we have fully developed those, we will live in the light of them. I don't think the Buddha taught this. I think the Buddha said we don't have to wait until we are fully awakened before we live in the light of our deepest aspirations and understandings. We don't have to wait for nibbana to cruise around our corner before we begin to live in the light of our knowing that life is ungraspable, that it's changing and uncertain. We don't have to wait for the moment that all ill will has vanished before we live with a commitment to kindness and compassion. It strikes me that inner development, cultivation, and embodiment need to go hand in hand. And I think this is not just, you know, not found only within Buddhist psychology. It's very much concerned with contemporary psychology, isn't it? How we think, how we feel, what we value shapes us behaviorally. But how we act, how we behave, shapes the state of our mind. This is a two-way street. It's not a one-way street. We would wish to live an embodied life. I think there's a seamlessness between our values and our understandings and all the ways we think. And I think there's a genuine humility in recognizing that embodiment is a path that asks us to embrace the moments that we stumble, embrace our fallibilities, embrace our moments of imperfection. Because I think without that humility, we often engage in kind of magical thinking. Again, the thinking that says, you know, I just need to sit more. You know, or I just need to do more retreats. But it's really about what happens when we open our eyes and engage with the world. And this is so, you know, the Buddha did not just teach formal practice, but the living of an awakened life. And much of the Eightfold Path is concerned with actually our way of being in the world and not our meditative state of the moment. Now, when I began to reflect on this theme, I really did have the sense about how the question of embodiment, I think, is challenging and even a deeply troubling question. And I think it's fine that that is so. I think if it wasn't troubling, we would be sitting amidst a room full of Buddhas, right? So we can accept that it's a troubling question, because the moment that we begin to reflect on embodiment, what do you become aware of? We become perhaps aware of the places we're doing pretty well, and perhaps we become aware of the places where there's a good deal of dissonance and the gaps between what we value and aspire to and how we live. And the question of a path is truly concerned with honestly embracing the awareness of those gaps. I don't know if any of you have ever traveled on the subway system in London, but they love minding the gaps, you know. All day long, people shout at you to mind the gaps, you know, and it's written on the subway platforms, you know, and you can buy mugs that say, and t-shirts that say, mind the gaps. And I think if there's one question that we would, or one question we would take into our life if we're really sincere about embodiment, is mind the gaps. And why do they promote that in the subway system? Because the gaps, if you fall in them, you're really in trouble. And I think this is true in our lives too. When we fall into the gaps, you know, get lost in the gaps between our aspirations and our lives, this is where we struggle. And it's also, have you noticed, it's the place where we're most unconscious. I hope you can see the relationship between heedlessness and dissonance, and the relationship between awareness or wakefulness and congruence. And where are the places that we find ourselves suffering and struggling most in our lives? Generally, these are the places of the greatest confusion and the greatest heedlessness and unconsciousness. Where are the places where there's the least residues and the least sense of dissonance? Much related to the degree of mindfulness and wakefulness in our life. So being a little bit aware of dissonance, you know, holding that reflection without it being a taboo area or something to be avoided, but an honest embracing. Probably everyone in this room really values compassion. And sometimes we just feel like we're too busy for it. Or it takes a moment of courage to pause and genuinely look into the eyes of a homeless person. We know in our own experience, and I'm sure I don't have to convince anyone in this room, we know the toxic power of craving, the never enough mind, and what it is doing to our planet and what it does to our own lives. But you know, that second plate of food is really looks tempting, and maybe it doesn't really matter. Isn't this the nature of dissonance, the feeling sometimes that it doesn't really matter? We wake up, probably most of us wake up in the morning with some degree of intention to be present and mindful. And you know, that open door of obsession looks so enticing. You know, that open door of preoccupation, fantasizing, forgetfulness is enticing. It's also habitual. Most of us, I'm sure everyone in this room, would value at least the idea of speaking with kindness. And we open our mouths, and sometimes that's not what pops out. That's not what jumps out. We probably would all wish or long to have a deeper sense of collectedness in our life. But again, distractedness seems to have payoff, doesn't it? It can be more pleasant, it can be more fun, you know, it can be more comforting. We know, everyone in this room knows that we cannot grasp the ever-changing, the instability of life, or we cannot find the ability to control the world of conditions. I can't say the train should stop running. But we do actually find ourselves rehearsing and trying to do a lot of that. Just a little bit more rearrangement. And then we'll stop rearranging. You notice that moment doesn't come very easily. So there's two questions, I think, in this investigation that I would ask you to reflect on. And I think the first of those reflections is really to bring into the light of a very conscious mindfulness the reflection on what we most deeply value and aspire to. Some years ago, I went to a friend's 70th birthday party. It started out like a normal party, like parties do. She was a practitioner of many years. And after about an hour, everybody was invited to go into another room and given a piece of slate and a piece of chalk and asked to write their own tombstone. It's not the usual birthday activity. And it's probably not what most people sort of had thought they were getting into. But I thought it was a very kind of focusing exercise. You know, what would I wish to be seen on my tombstone? You know, not here's the person who made a negotiated settlement with dissonance. You know, or, you know, here lies the person who wished to be kinder. And it was just a very focusing kind of exercise. So in a sense, that's the first question I would invite you to embrace. What is it that we most deeply value and aspire to in our life? And the second question is, around dissonance. What are the gaps we fall into? What are the areas of dissonance that we feel most uncomfortable with in our lives? And what is our reaction to the awareness of dissonance? What is our reaction to the awareness of dissonance in our own life? Those gaps between what we value and how we live. I think we'll take just a little pause moment now before I go on. Is there anything that comes up in your mind, anything you want to reflect on more or have questions about? Yeah, Candace. What are the areas of dissonance that we feel mostly aware of when we take the time to listen? The gaps that seem to repeat themselves. But more importantly, what is our reaction to dissonance? Because I think it's often very much our reaction to dissonance that gets in our way of examining and investigating those areas with some compassion and with some honesty. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the reflection that was raised, for those of you who couldn't hear it, was dissonance often evokes a sense of disappointment inwardly. And, you know, often what follows in the footsteps of that is a lot of judgment, shame, blame. I think, you know, before people begin to practice, it felt like, you know, quite enough to get through this life without, you know, in a reasonably respectful way. I think when people begin to practice, their portfolio of expectation increases magnificently. So it's no longer enough just to get through life in a really respectful way. Now we have this very, very long list of aspirations and values that define awakening. You know, now compassion, kindness, generosity, empathy, integrity, you know, our portfolio of becoming, which it can be turned into, by the way, can be turned into a portfolio of becoming, suddenly grows. Now I should be like this. Now I should be like that. And there's, I think, a very real question of, in, you know, for many people on this path, is how to truly absorb those aspirations and values, which really only mirror that which hasn't been so articulated inwardly. How to truly absorb them, to naturalize them, without turning them into a portfolio of becoming, which is a much more sophisticated form of grasping, by the way. You know, and a more sophisticated form often of judgment, you know, that I should be like this, I should be like that. You know, if I was a really mindful person, I would be like this.
Would disharmony be another way, word for dissonance?
Is disharmony another word for dissonance? Yes. Yes. Did everybody hear that? That the real suffering seems to come from not being aware of the gaps, whereas being aware of the gaps provides that space for forgiveness, provides that space for having a path. Is that?
Well, and you just talk about it as sort of a discomfort there, which doesn't seem to be the case.
But I think there's two kinds of suffering in this world. One of it is very much in this realm of unconscious suffering, you know, that things happen and I feel such a mess and I feel so confused and I keep ending up in places where I don't want to be and I don't know how it all happened. And that's a terrible suffering, because there's not only the anguish of it, but there's also the helplessness of it. And then there is also a discomfort in waking up, which actually I'm going to get into. But it's not a negative discomfort, you know. It can be startling and it can be at times disappointing, but it doesn't have to be that kind of unconscious sense of being trapped and imprisoned. So dissonance, I think this exploration of dissonance, disconnection, disharmony, gaps, it's really speaking to the places where there's a discrepancy between our understandings, our intentions, our aspirations, and their embodiment. And this can sound like very bad news, and it's very easy to be judgmental, it's very easy to be despairing, feeling I can never change. It's very easy at times for people to embrace a sense of failure or impossibility. But in my understanding, the Buddha clearly recognized there is a tension in learning to live a more wakeful life. And it's easy to view the gaps as a negative tension. And then we become very blaming, or we give up, or we fill our lives with shoulds. Or we could recognize, I think very much as the Buddha did, that this is a creative tension. This is where we practice. This is a path to heal the gaps, to free ourselves of dissonance. Now, you know, even if you really look at the Satipatthana Sutta and the fourth way of establishing mindfulness, I think it speaks very directly to this creative tension. I mean, most scholars, when they're trying to come closely, as close as they can, to understanding what the Buddha taught, they look at the different translations of the early texts in Pali, in Sanskrit, and in Chinese. And in the Satipatthana discourse, the primary discourse, as you know, of establishing wakefulness, the fourth way of establishing mindfulness, the only congruence between those three different translations, is setting side by side the hindrance factors and the awakening factors. And for me, this so much exemplifies this kind of creative tension, that we don't begin to embark on a path of awakening in a vacuum. We begin to embark on a path of awakening amidst the habit patterns, amidst the conditioning, amidst the difficult mental states, amidst the confusion. And this is actually our classroom. Now, I think anyone, and I'm sure this has happened for all of you, that anyone sort of who begins to embark on a path of awakening is quite soon shorn of romanticism. You know, and I, you know, discovered this very, very early on in my own practice in Asia, you know, where, you know, the warrior spirit was really on the front burner, you know, and we reckoned this, you know, wasn't going to take much time. We read that business of even 7 days to achieve full awakening. And, you know, we were all pretty shorn of romanticism quite quickly. That all we have to do is make a little effort or have good intentions and our mind is transformed. And I think we soon come to recognize that there are a few, sometimes a number, of quite deeply embedded psychological and emotional habit patterns that repeat, the repeaters, that can easily dominate our lives. And we see the kind of landscape of the impulses and the reactivity that can take us to places really far from where we want to be. So that is where the awakening factors really come in. You know, this pathway, someone said, the road to liberation is not paved. This is where the factors of perseverance, of courage, the genuine willingness to look at the questions of dissonance and embodiment, and learning to liberate the moment. So there's three areas of embodiment that I really want to focus on over these days. One of them is, what does it mean to be an embodied human being, a person who actually knows how to inhabit their body fully? Because for me, this is a bigger question of how do we inhabit our life more fully. The second area I'd really like to reflect on is the embodiment of the attitudes, the qualities that truly transform our hearts and lives. And the third area I'd like us to reflect on is the embodiment of insight, the embodiment of understanding, and what that looks like in our lives.